Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
318 points on the Dow, you guys. Everybody panic. Or not. Come on, will you? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Friday, the 24th of January. Good as always to have you with us, everybody. And listen, I know the odds are against it, but I honestly think we might have broken the stock market. I mean, no sooner do we point out the looming fifth anniversary of the post-Lehman bull markets the other day. Good to have you with us this 22nd of January, or as we have taken to referring to it around here, the 1,780th day of the bull market. And boom, there you go. Wall Street has up and rolled over. The Dow, the S&P, all of them. And it's not just us either. Europe, Asia, it is ugly out there. So with that as a backdrop, this seems as good a time as any for four or so minutes of live radio to review the 5 days gone by. Here for our weekly wrapper, Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine, John Carney from CNBC. They are in our New York studios. Hey, guys.
Hi, Kai.
Hi, Kai.
All right, John, so first of all, deep breath, right? I mean, it's a lousy, what, couple of 4% after just an awesome run-up the past, however long it's been, right?
Well, last year was one of the most epic years in stock market history. We've been saying for a long time that we were overdue for something like a correction. Now we're getting the beginning of that. It shouldn't be very surprising to anybody, and it's no reason to panic.
Lee, you think it is the beginning of a correction, or is this just a little blurble?
I would hesitate to say correction yet because all of the indicators and fundamentals have not changed. I think one thing that happened last year, it was really singular in the lack of not only the rise, but just the lack of volatility. We kind of forgot what it was like to bounce around so much. And if you remember back into the days of 2009, 2010, 300-point swings happened all the time. Yeah. And the market last year started going up, and with a few exceptions, it just didn't stop. And so, risk was suppressed, and now it's kind of back in. Maybe it's temporary. Maybe it's here to stay. We don't quite know yet.
John, that thing that Lee said, the underlying fundamentals are basically strong. You agree with that?
You know, I'm not so sure. We've been seeing, hints of slowdowns in different places. The housing market hasn't shut down, but it's slowed down. It was a little weaker than expected. Manufacturing in the U.S. is a little weaker than expected. So this could be the beginning of, signs that things aren't going to go as strong as people had hoped they would in 2014.
Lee, give me the proximate cause of this week's decline, right? We had Chinese manufacturing on Wednesday and then weak housing sales. What else? There was emerging markets. There was a bunch of stuff.
Also, in general, earnings season has really failed to kind of knock it out of the park. And I think that's got a lot of people concerned because, it's only companies can't continue to lap their earnings gains. And so that train might be slowing down a little bit on a more, non-cyclical level, I guess.
Wow, that was very technical. What does lap their earnings gains mean? That do better than previous earnings? Is that what that
yes,
means?
Yes, exactly. Sorry,
right.
I was a swimmer.
No, that's all right. John, I heard somebody say on your network today, CNBC, that the markets are looking to sell now as opposed to having been looking to buy the past year. You buy that?
That's the sort of thing we'd like to say. look, people, I think a lot of people.
What does it mean, John? What does it mean?
Look, it means that there's a lot of people out there who were perhaps not as bullish as they should have been last year and sort of missed the boat on that, got bullish at the end of the year. And now people are, a little bit nervous. Like I said, we're overdue for a correction. You typically have corrections, every 20 months or so. We've gone a long time without a formal, big drop in the market. And so, we're going to get one at some point, and, that's the way healthy markets operate. Yeah. It's no reason to panic.
All right. Quickly, Lee, on the way out, a totally different topic. Jamie Dimon, the CEO of JPMorgan Chase, got a big pay cut last year after the bank had some problems. We learned this morning he got a 75% raise. I mean, he went from $11 million to $20 million after the year that bank has had. Come on.
Well, you know, look at it this way. This board has stood behind Jamie Dimon over and over again. If you remember when it was there was pressure for him to split the chairman and CEO roles. The company is doing very well. And this is what happens when companies do well. Their CEOs get rewarded. So it's hard to see that through the, I mean, Michigas is putting it mildly of last year. But, he did work very hard.
Yeah, well, he worked very hard fending off regulators, right, John? I mean, you know.
Look, here's the big problem with his big raise, right? It makes a mockery of his pay cut last year because he just gets it all back the next year. This is a terrible lesson for CEOs everywhere. It's like, okay, we'll pretend to punish you 1 year. And so really all you got was a delay in your extra $10 million. So,
all right, there you go. John Carney. Yeah, no. John Carney from CNBC, Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine. We'll see you guys later.
Thanks, Kai.
Thanks, Kai.
All right, have a good weekend. On Wall Street today, I'm guessing the Wawa trombones, but I don't run this place. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We talked a little bit, John Lee and I did, about why what's going on Wall Street is going on. Stock markets overseas in part. Also, currencies overseas. Those in the developing world in particular have been sliding, none more so than Argentina. The Argentine peso slid 16% against the dollar this week, which is huge in foreign exchange trades, and which has in turn brought back memories of the Argentinian financial crisis back in 2001. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore explains what's going on down there.
Agustino Fontevecchia is Argentinian. He writes for Forbes, and here's how he describes the atmosphere in his country.
Fear, uncertainty, abandonment or confusion.
There's high inflation, approaching 30%, and shortages.
There's been problems finding a lot of the basic supplies from food to, electronics.
And now there's the massive devaluation of its currency.
It's been like a slow-motion train wreck.
Win Thin directs emerging market strategy at Brown Brothers Harriman. He says Argentina has been suffering from economic mismanagement since it defaulted on its sovereign debt in 2001. Since then, nobody's wanted to lend to it. But Argentina kept spending. Peter Hakam is president emeritus of the Inter-American Dialogue.
Huge expenditures on social programs, huge government subsidies in the airlines, energy subsidies.
The government was able to coast for a while on revenue from exports, but eventually all the spending caused massive inflation. The peso fell in value. People started switching to dollars.
What's happening is a flood of capital out of Argentina.
The government tried to keep the money from moving, and that caused people to worry more. Keith Savard is a senior economist at the Milken Institute.
It's a classic situation of what happens to emerging markets when policy is ineptly followed.
Argentina's problems reflect a difficult period for developing economies. As richer countries recover economically, money and investment are moving out of the developing world. The weakest links among them are getting exposed. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
There's news to pass on about banking and pot, to be totally upfront about it. Eric Holder, the Attorney General of these United States, said yesterday he thinks marijuana sellers in states where it's legal ought to be able to use the banking system. He's working on some new guidelines, he said. No timeline provided for those. But in the meanwhile, as Sally Herships reports, marijuana retailers continue to pay a high price in a cash economy.
Great news for retailers selling recreational marijuana in Colorado legally. Business is good. Tim Cullen is co-owner of Evergreen Apothecary and Colorado Harvest Company.
We have over 100 employees at this point. We lease 6 different buildings.
There's just one drawback to selling all that cannabis. It's all the cash. According to federal law, marijuana is illegal, so banks won't take retailers' money, which means businesses like Cullen's have to find a workaround.
We use a third party that we pay pretty substantial fees to that allows us to have access to bank accounts.
Are you basically like renting an account from someone, or what? At a third party sounds sort of vague and mysterious.
Right, I'm going to leave it at vague and mysterious because I need to keep my bank accounts open.
But most marijuana sellers are stuck with cash only, according to Taylor West with the National Cannabis Industry Association.
People are literally having to bring bags of cash in to pay licensing fees, state taxes, even utility bills that can run in the thousands of dollars a month.
Then there's the safety issue.
We have heard of members that have to use decoy cars and multiple people leaving at the same time and going in different directions.
But all the retailers still have to pay state sales tax. Until the rules change, the Colorado Department of Revenue says it does accept cash. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Here with some trends of late in the American workforce. Item number one, we've got the highest number of people working involuntarily part-time since the 1950s. In other words, they can't find full-time jobs. Item two, an increase in temporary and contract jobs. That is the kind that go away after a certain period of time. Both of which lead to item three, people taking a couple of three jobs just to make ends meet. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has been looking at how that affects people's lives, both in and out of the workplace.
It's 12:30 in the morning at a 7-Eleven in Portland, Oregon, and I'm here to meet Jake Gerke. He's working the graveyard.
Tell me all the different jobs you do.
I work here. I work at a place called MDC Research. I recruit for focus groups. It's a call center. I also teach ESL, and I do data entry on the side. So there's four for those keeping track.
Gerke will get off his shift around 8 a.m. and have to be at the call center by noon. Both jobs pay just above minimum wage, but 7-Eleven's more interesting.
You can't have a conversation with somebody at 3 o'clock in the morning inside a 7-Eleven and it not be interesting. Drugs, music, movies, current events.
Gerke's 26 with an associate's degree, and he admits this is not what he anticipated. His mom worked full-time as an accountant.
But definitely things have changed in the last, 20 years. And while it would be nice to just settle down at one job, I would definitely miss this aspect of seeing just a wide variety of people.
So Gerke sees a social silver lining in this roving work life. But historian Stephanie Kuntz of the Council on Contemporary Families says there's also a high social cost from people not knowing if they'll be called into work or for how long or how much money they'll make.
That kind of economic insecurity is just a relationship killer. People take less notice of the good things that their partner or their child does. They're much more sensitive to the irritating things, and all of these erode family life.
The job scramble definitely takes a toll. Lane Yacopin-Montrose teaches Zumba at a suburban gym.
Wednesdays are my long days. I start at 8:30. I teach the dance fitness class. Then I drive over to the bar. I bartend from 10:30 to 5:30. I drive back over to the gym and teach another class.
Yacopin-Montrose is in her mid-30s, married, no kids. She says the bartending pays pretty well, but she's looking for yet another part-time job. The restaurant chain, where she's worked for 14 years, just cut her hours and dropped her health coverage.
I feel like I'm supposed to have a career. I'm 35 years old, and I don't have a job that is feeding into my 401k to prepare for my adulthood.
And yet, like Jake Gerke, she says she wouldn't trade in her runaround life for a steady 9-to-5.
I kind of like the gypsy employment. I meet so many great people, and I don't get bored at one place. I'm not working with the same people day in, day out.
Now, none of the people I interviewed for this story have chosen this style of work entirely voluntarily. They're hustling multiple part-time jobs because there aren't enough full-time jobs out there. But they've also come to think, or perhaps convince themselves, that they genuinely like the daily churn, the different workplaces, clients, coworkers. Maybe if you can't beat the new economy, you might as well join it. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Coming up,
we want to create some of that buzz ahead of the game where people are talking about it with friends and family.
Commercials for Super Bowl commercials. Yes, indeedy. But first, let's do the numbers. Told you. Told you it'd be the Wawa's. All right, the Dow Industrial slipped 318 points, almost 2%. Closed at 15,879. The NASDAQ off 90 points, more than 2%. Ended things at 4128. The S&P 500 fell 38 points, about 2%. Finished at 1790. For the week that was, the Dow off 3.5%. The NASDAQ retreated 1.7%. The S&P 500 down 2.6%. Construction equipment maker Caterpillar shed 2.6% today. General Electric dimmed almost 3.3%. Aircraft company Boeing descended 3.3%. Microsoft, however, clicked up 2%. The software giant reported better-than-expected quarterly earnings on strong demand for its new Xbox console, apparently. But slot machine maker International Gaming Technology down 14.75% today after posting first-quarter profits that missed expectations. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.72%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Monday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on sales of new homes for December. Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart was born on Monday's date in 1756, and it's Bubble Wrap Appreciation Day. So let's take some time to appreciate this plastic protector of precious packable possessions. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We can, if we so choose, know a whole bunch about our food these days. How many calories, how much fat, and how much fiber in a single serving of, I don't know, Cheez-Its? It's all thanks to that little box on the back of the box, of course, the nutritional label. And now, for the first time in almost 20 years, those little boxes are getting a makeover. Easier to see calorie counts, more up-to-date serving sizes. You get the picture. From the Health Desk at WHYY, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein reports.
It's pretty easy to see America's got a problem with eating.
Based on the waistlines of Americans.
Phil Lempert is the editor of SupermarketGuru.com.
More heart disease, more early onset diabetes, seeing early teens that are 300-400 pounds.
Lempert says part of the problem is that too many consumers are lost when they check out that nutrition label. The new one could clear things up for shoppers and put some pressure on food companies.
I do think that food manufacturers are going to look very carefully at this and try to take advantage of this so their ingredients and the nutritional information becomes a marketing advantage.
So does that mean we're going to see an explosion of whole wheat, tofu, and kale and everything? Ann Yakteen, head of the Food and Nutrition Board at the Institute of Medicine, says baby steps.
I'm not convinced that manufacturers are going to radically change what their food products are now.
Yakteen says over the past several years, food companies have started to offer consumers different choices. Just walk down the 50-mile-long chip aisle.
Food, and you can see, you know, all kinds of different low-sodium, low-fat, low-calorie, whatever.
More than anything, Yakteen thinks new labels will make it easier for consumers, maybe easier to find information. But we haven't yet met a label that makes it easy to put down the Flamin' Hot Cheetos. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
We should all just face it, I think. This is a Silicon economy, and we are just living in it. Cities and regions all across the country are desperate to attract high-tech startups. Whether it's the Silicon Prairies of the Midwest or Silicon Beach in Los Angeles, city budgets would love them, a piece of that Silicon pie. So Marketplace's David Weinberg took a trip down south to Silicon Bayou to see how Louisiana is trying to lure tech to the swamp.
When I walked into Captiville in downtown New Orleans, there was only one other person at the bar, a guy on his laptop, nursing a glass of red wine. But within an hour, the place was packed.
Captiville was originally opened as a rock and roll whiskey-themed bar, and we evolved into this hub for this really awesome tech group of New Orleans.
Maisha Dunn has been a bartender at Captiville since it opened 4 years ago. Many of the regulars work next door at a co-working space called Launchpad.
I'm going to throw something in here, too. So for people,
I wandered over to Launchpad, where Paul Thiel was leading a monthly gathering of video game developers. Before moving here, Thiel worked for EA on the blockbuster game Madden. He moved to New Orleans to work for TurboSquid, a company with 80 employees.
Turbo Squid is it's a marketplace similar to like a stock photo marketplace, like iStockPhoto or Getty Images or something, but focused on 3D models.
When you play a video game or watch a Pixar movie, every object on the screen has to be made by a game developer or an animator, or they could buy those objects on Turbo Squid. Teal pulls up a digital model that's a replica of the microphone I'm holding.
You can see the lines on it. That's the actual mesh. So that's how he built it.
The price, $199. Turbo Squid could be headquartered anywhere, but when it comes to hiring employees, New Orleans has an advantage over cities where the living expenses are higher.
I feel like it was the best move I've ever made. I love living here.
What is also luring tech companies to Louisiana is some of the most generous tax credits in the country. Digital media companies can get 25% back on what they spend on production and 35% on payroll. Electronic Arts built its North American testing center in Baton Rouge and says it brought in nearly $7 million in payroll to the state. Chris Schultz is the founder of Launchpad and has his own startups. He's also a self-described Pied Piper of Silicon Bayou.
Well, I think there's businesses where you have a natural competitive advantage by being in New Orleans.
For startups that want to develop software related to food or music or the oil and gas industry, Silicon Bayou is ideal. And, says Schultz, the culture of New Orleans itself is a big draw.
New Orleans serves as kind of this creative muse for a lot of people.
But at the same time, the idea of a Silicon Bayou or a Silicon Prairie, Silicon you name it, is becoming meaningless because technology is becoming a part of all businesses.
A lot of traditional industries are becoming kind of tech-enabled. They're becoming, you know, as Marc Andreessen says, software is eating the world.
To understand what happens when software eats the world, I talked to Brian Bordanik, the CEO of Dinner Lab, a New Orleans startup that built software to eat, appropriately, the restaurant industry.
So Dinner Lab hosts pop-up events in about 10 cities across the United States.
Dinner Lab is a 21st century supper club. Members pay an annual fee plus an additional $50 to $70 per dinner, where up-and-coming chefs serve food in places like warehouses and rooftops. But the whole experience is really about data. It comes in the form of feedback cards.
Typically, restaurants see about 0.25% of people who actually fill out feedback cards. We bat about 95%.
Dinner Club is essentially a focus group. Bordanik believes that the feedback his company provides chefs will help them plan new menus and take some of the risk out of opening a new restaurant. When Bordanik started Dinner Lab, several people told him that no one would fund a New Orleans startup.
You know, we're living proof to say it's not true. We had one employee this time last year, and we have 50 now.
In New Orleans, I'm David Weinberg for Marketplace.
All right, now that I'm on the record as wanting the Broncos to win the Super Bowl, let's all just move on, shall we, to the actual broadcast of the game and the ads that will air therein. We've still got more than a week to go, but advertisers seem not to be content to wait. They are rolling out teasers online and on TV. Yes, they are ads promoting the ads, ladies and gentlemen. It's come to that. Marketplace's Amy Scott has the story of how a 30-second spot on game day has become a weeks-long media blitz.
In this Toyota teaser on YouTube, actor and former football player Terry Crews drives down a dusty road and encounters a seemingly abandoned painted bus.
Anybody need help?
It looks pretty much like a movie trailer, which makes sense because there is a tie-in with the new Muppets movie coming out in March. But this trailer is promoting Toyota's Super Bowl ad, coming out in the second quarter of the game. Russ Cobley is advertising manager for Toyota Motor Sales USA.
We want to try to build as much engagement before the game and create some of that buzz ahead of the game where people are talking about it with friends and family.
Ah, the magic words of marketing in the age of social media. Engagement. Buzz.
This year we're seeing more elaborate campaigns in advance of the Super Bowl than we have ever seen before.
Tim Calkins teaches marketing at Northwestern University's Kellogg School of Management. He points to Bud Light. It's running six different teasers on the web and on TV.
I suspect when everything's done, Bud Light would have spent as much on the teaser spots as they would have spent on the actual Super Bowl.
Volkswagen's Justin Osborne says, all told, a Super Bowl campaign can run around $10 million these days, but that can buy a lot of attention.
Now, all of a sudden, for this two-week period,
everyone in America is actually interested in advertising and actually wants to watch it. And so it's a great way for us to extend the actual spot itself.
VW unveiled this teaser this week, poking fun at the mania.
By isolating your most successful humor ads, we have developed an algorithm to make the ultimate commercial for your big American football festival. Let's watch.
Let's just say the car is the least memorable part. Some companies still prefer the surprise attack. For several years, Chrysler has kept mum about its plans for the big game and then made a big splash, like with last year's God Made a Farmer ad featuring a speech by the late broadcaster Paul Harvey. Amy Beamer is with SpotBowl.com.
It was a surprise. People were engaged. All that stuff was just tied up in a very neat bow, and they got a lot of traction there.
Because teaser or no teaser, more than 100 million viewers tune in to watch the Super Bowl. And Beamer says as many as half of them are there just for the ads. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, which is either amazing business acumen or way too much information. Procter & Gamble reported quarterly profits this morning. Down 16%, not a good thing. It happened in part because sales at Gillette were off, as beards and mustaches are apparently becoming more popular. Who knew? Chief Financial Officer John Mueller said this to the Financial Times, and this is a quote, "While the incidence of facial shaving is somewhat down, the incidence of body shaving is up, and we can take advantage of that." So there you go, into your weekend, and no, you can't unhear that, can you? No, I didn't think so. All right, that's Marketplace from APM on a Friday. Today on Wall Street, well, you know what happened there. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace was developed by JJ Yore. The program is produced by Sitar Nieves. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you Monday, everybody. Have a good weekend. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.